Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lauren Whitley with the Richmond Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Hunter. And we're before the court today on two assignments of error, specifically addressing the issue regarding intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill in this case. Mr. Hunter was convicted of unlawful wounding by the trial court, and the trial court correctly made a finding of fact that there was not an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. The error arises specifically under our first assignment when he still convicted Mr. Hunter of unlawful.
Aren't you being a little loose with that, actually what the trial court said? The trial court didn't say, I specifically find that he had no intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. His statement, I thought, was a lot more ambiguous than that.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree as far as the language that was used. I think the trial court was fairly clear, and I'd point the court to the joint appendix page 107 through 108. The court essentially is contrasting the facts of this case with an unpublished case from this court in Carnes against Commonwealth. And in Carnes, that also involved an item in someone's hand, the defendant's hand, when he hit the complaining witness and caused a severe injury. And I'm going to quote for Your Honor, the court states that So let me just explain again. Carnes actually showed the victim what he was going to use to hit him with. We don't have that piece of the puzzle here, so it almost causes the court, that's a factual distinction between this case and the other case. Something other than his fist, the court believes, caused the injury to his face. And this is the most important part that I would highlight. The court said, I don't know, and there's been no indication that he actually knew that the ring would cause that type of injury, which is another issue. And I highlight that to the court. He doesn't make an explicit statement. I find there's no intent.
You have to interpret that as a finding.
Well, I think that that is what the court was saying. Yes, sir. I think that's what the record establishes.
That would be inconsistent with his verdict.
Right. That's correct. Because at most at that stage, what Mr. Hunter could have been convicted of was assault and battery. And I would highlight to the court, there's two cases that...
So was it brought to his attention by trial counsel at the time?
Not at that time, but trial counsel did argue in his motion to strike and renewed motion to strike about intent being an element of the offense.
That statement from Judge Jenkins came during the course of his ruling.
That's correct.
So after the motion to strike.
That's correct.
So what about the Commonwealth's argument regarding waiver, the fact that it wasn't brought to Judge Jenkins' attention at the time?
And I think I have two responses to that. First, the case that the Commonwealth relies on, Robertson, is distinguishable because in Robertson, the trial court was finding no force, threat, or intimidation and amending the charge to a sexual battery, which also required an element of force, threat, or intimidation. And the defendant's counsel never brought to the trial court's attention, oh, hey, that element is also required for the misdemeanor. Here, at the renewed motion to strike, Mr. Hunter's counsel made clear, and this is at joint appendix page 98 through 99, he's talking about the elements. There's a reasonable doubt that it was the ring that caused that, that it was caused while he was defending himself, that it was a self-defense type case, which is part of the kind of there's two defenses going on. But the most important part is he says, from somebody who kept approaching him, and without that, I think you fail with malice and intent to disfigure, disable, or kill, which I think brings it down to a misdemeanor. And that very argument distinguishes this case from Robertson. So at the renewed motion to strike, defense counsel brought to the trial court's attention, without malice, without intent, at most, what we have is a misdemeanor. And I would also highlight to this court in Jones against Commonwealth, which is
to follow up on Judge Atlee's question, if, you know, the argument is made,
right.
But if the problem, the error that the court made was to find him guilty of the felony, but say that if he's saying here that there was no indication that he actually knew the ring would cause that type of injury, so therefore you didn't have the necessary mens rea, essentially.
Right.
But yet the court then ruled what it did. You'd almost have to bring it to the court's attention after the ruling, not before, right?
Well, I think there are two ways to address it.
A motion to set aside or a motion to reconsider or something.
And certainly that's one avenue. But I would highlight in Jones against Commonwealth, a very similar procedure happened. It was the language used there was a little more specific by the trial court, but the defense attorney had argued at the motion to strike and renewed motion to strike that there was insufficient evidence of intent to permanently disable. There was no motion to set aside that I can recollect from the Jones case. There was no objection, Your Honor, during the trial court's findings. The court is finding him guilty of unlawful, but has found there was no intent. And this court, in a footnote, in responding to the Commonwealth's argument, the that issue had been waived, cited the motion to strike and renewed motion to strike as preserving that issue before the trial court. And I think that that is a similar circumstance as we have here. At the renewed motion to strike, the trial counsel did say, without intent, without malice, what we're left with is a misdemeanor. And I think that then brought to the trial court's attention, if you find there's no intent, the only conviction is an assault.
Why can't, I mean, we don't fixate generally on isolated comments by a trial court, particularly ones that are ambiguous, such as this one. Why couldn't the trial court have been talking about the element of malice as opposed to intent?
Right. And I think, Your Honor, what that record lays out in reading the record in its entirety during the trial court's findings, one, it's not an isolated statement. The trial court is making an analysis of the Carnes case and is distinguishing the facts as presented here from the Carnes case. So I would certainly say this is not a throwaway statement from the trial court. This is in the midst of him working through direction from this court in the Carnes case and saying, we don't have similar facts here. I don't think that Mr. Hunter knew the ring would cause this injury, whereas in Carnes, this court found that the defendant did. The second point I'd make with regards to the ambiguity of the statements, this court addressed ambiguous statements or kind of partial statements in different parts of the record in Williams against Commonwealth. That was an aggravated malicious wounding. The complaining witness had lost his eye, and during the course of rendering its ruling, the trial court made a number of statements, including, I don't think it was intentionally aggravated malicious. He makes statements, I mean, it's just happened, that's what he used, but I don't think he was trying to do what ended up happening. I do believe it was malicious with no intent. And in putting all of that together, this court said the trial court found there was no intent, so it could not convict of the felony that it convicted of.
Those statements, though, were a lot more explicit than what we have here before us. I mean, those were a clear indication that he was talking about the element of intent that may disfigure, et cetera.
And I would argue this is just as clear to the court, even on the plain face of the record. I also think
But the trial, if it were that clear and if that's what the trial court meant, then that is inconsistent with his verdict and his decision on the motion to set aside the verdict. So, I mean, he must have decided that's not what he meant when he said that. Otherwise, he would have had to grant.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe there was a motion to set aside in this case.
Sorry.
So just at the moment that he was rendering the ruling, Your Honor, I think that language that he used in the context of Carnes does make it clear. It is not as clean as the language that was in Jones. We would certainly admit that. However, what he is saying is, I don't know, and there's been no indication that he actually knew that the ring would cause that type of injury.
And doesn't that have to go in the context of, my reading of the record reflects that the trial judge had a hard time believing that a ring caused that injury. Because when you see the photographs,
right,
we're talking about a severe injury, but that he appeared to kind of hold his nose and accept it because the doctor said that, well, it's possible that the ring could have caused that injury if it's a jagged stone and it was raked down the side of his face. But because the judge didn't have evidence of another weapon specifically before him, he was kind of stuck with the ring.
Yes, but also I would highlight some other facts that did come out in the record from the doctor about the picture. The exhibit that was introduced is very alarming, for sure. However, the doctor also made a point of testifying that it wasn't, he said, not a significant wound, that in another part of the body would have been superficial. I do believe the trial court made mention of box cutters. Usually you see this type of injury with box cutters or knives. However, what the court was looking at was the intent of Mr. Hunter at the time that action occurred. So he's looking at
what he actually knows or should have known.
Right, exactly.
And saying that he didn't actually know it is not the same as saying he shouldn't have known it.
Well, I think what the court looks at with Carnes and what the court is trying to determine is this court and the Supreme Court have said when you use a weapon, a deadly weapon or a weapon, that you can infer the natural and probable consequences of that use, right? So in Carnes, when the defendant said, you see this, and showed the complaining witness something shiny in his hands and a very kind of brutal injury occurred, this court said the defendant knew what he was doing, whether it was brass knuckles or a roll of quarters in a sock or a ring, the injury that occurred, the defendant could have predicted.
And you have to factor in the fact that there's a finding here that the victim was sucker punched. repeatedly when he's in a vulnerable position.
Well, he made comments about the injury being severe because he felt that the defendant was holding groceries and was surprised by the attack. However, he doesn't connect that to Mr. Hunter's state of mind, his intent. And I would go back, Judge Petty, to your question about malice. What also makes clear in the trial court's rendering of its ruling is he felt that because it occurred during an incident of rage and heat of passion, that negated the malice. And that at the very end of his ruling, he does make a statement about, you know, that's why I will find you guilty of unlawful wounding.
But the circumstances can't be disconnected from what someone intends or should know by the consequences. Because if I go after you, I know whether you've got something in your hands. I know whether you're in a vulnerable position or not. And by all accounts, and I think there was a finding made that this was a sucker punch type situation.
And I respectfully disagree just from the plain language of the trial court
when
it was rendering its ruling.
Certainly a reasonable inference to be gleaned from this record.
I think, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think from this record, what is established in the facts and what the trial court relies on in making its ruling is that the injury was so severe because of the circumstances as far as holding groceries and circling from in front and surprising him. However, if you read the record closely, what is established is it was not a surprise attack. They were engaged in a verbal altercation in the elevator and outside the elevator, and as well that the Mr. Johnson, the complaining witness in this case, had one hand free. He was holding juice in one hand and cigarettes in his pocket was his testimony about the groceries. But what's important is the trial court doesn't connect that to Mr. Hunter's intent to permanently disable. And again, we look back to the language of Williams, where the court talks about even though the complaining witness lost an eye, it was an unlucky hit, that the individual meant to hit him somewhere else. He hit him in the eye. It was a horrible injury, but it doesn't mean that he had the intent to permanently disable.
But the testimony from the expert in this case was that one punch would not have caused this.
That's correct. That's correct.
We know that this is more of an attack situation as opposed to just one punch.
Well, and I think, Your Honor, what the trial court was struggling with was determining whether or not the ring that Mr. Hunter was wearing, because the doctor who testified made clear that it was not a simple punch. Something else had to probably be present.
Nobody looks at these pictures and thinks that a ring caused that.
Well, that was the evidence that was before the trial court, Your Honor, and there was no.
Well, the evidence before the trial court was not that a ring caused it, but that it was possible that under the right circumstances there were jagged stone on the ring could have caused it.
And that was the only evidence of an item that was present besides bare fists.
But that's not the same as definitive proof that a ring did in fact cause the injury.
And I'm not sure the question that Your Honor has about that. I apologize. I feel like I'm not answering it.
Nobody really looks at that photograph and thinks that a ring caused that injury. That's not the reasonable conclusion or inference that's drawn when you look at that photograph.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think what the trial court stated, and that is what this court, we've directed this court and asked this court to look at with the first assignment of error, is that he only had the ring at most to rely on in the record. The Commonwealth did not introduce any other facts of weapons for him to rely on, and in looking at the ring, he could not say that Mr. Hunter knew the ring would cause, because it is a surprise.
I just want to let you know that you're going into your rebuttal time.
Yes, sir. If I could save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Mr. Hunter's conviction of unlawful wounding because the evidence was sufficient and for the other reasons that we mentioned on brief.
Mr. Jones, if you take the cut aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
Hard to take it aside in this, but take the cut aside. You have the trial court's finding that the broken nose came as a result of this surprise attack. Why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, I believe that it is enough, and that was actually the first point that I was going to make, is that Hunter hasn't even addressed the other injuries that occurred to Mr. Johnson from as a result of the attack. He didn't just have one slash across the face, but rather he was punched on the left side of his face twice. He had broken bones the broken nasal bone and the cheekbone were both broken as a result of that. And then there was also the third injury, which occurred on the right side of his face, which is that horrible gash that is reflected in the pictures. So Hunter hasn't addressed the fact that that there's sufficient evidence in those first two punches to convict him of certainly of unlawful wounding to support that conviction. There was no ring involved in that, and so the outcome of this case is really driven by that larger sufficiency question. There's been no error assigned to anything related to those first two punches, and the evidence was sufficient there. So the question about the trial court's ambiguous statement, I think, is somewhat academic to the overall question of whether this conviction gets reversed. I don't think there's any way for the court to reverse it in the posture that we find ourselves in here.
Speaking of the trial court statement, does the renewed motion to strike preserve the issue of essentially challenging that trial court statement and its inconsistency with the court's ultimate conviction in this case? And if not, why not?
It does not preserve assignment of error one. I think that it does. I think that assignment of error two is preserved, the general challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence on intent. But the first assignment of error, it actually says that the trial court erred by, after making a finding of fact that there was no intent, proceeding to convict Hunter. And that specifically references a statement that was made after the renewed motion to strike. So when you look at the contemporaneous objection rule, our case law is very clear that an objection needs to be made at the time that the basis for the objection becomes known. So here, the basis of the objection would have been during the trial court's announcement of its verdict. Mr. Hunter kept his peace, perhaps to protect the windfall that he was getting by being reduced from malicious wounding to unlawful wounding, but we don't know why. But he never raised the trial court's attention to that statement that it had made. When we look at Jones, I recognize that the trial court, or that this court in Jones, addressed the same sort of preservation issue. But if you look at the assignment of error that was involved in Jones, if you look at footnote one, the assignment of error was just a general intent sufficiency of the evidence. It didn't. The assignment of error in that case didn't invoke the trial court's statement.
Jones was an unpublished.
It was an unpublished.
Yeah, well, perhaps there's a reason why it was an unpublished opinion.
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to bring.
I'm somewhat familiar with Jones.
Yes, Your Honor. But at any rate, it was incumbent on Hunter to raise the trial court's attention to what it had just said, and his position that it was it functioned as a factual finding that there was no intent. Didn't do that. The trial court was in a much better position to clarify what it meant than this court is to divine what it meant by that, and I think the court's already latched on to the fact that it was ambiguous at best statement.
In order to support a conviction for, in this case, unlawful wounding, is it necessary for the Commonwealth to prove exactly what caused an injury like that? Must the Commonwealth prove that a knife was used, that a razor was used, or can it just rely upon the injury itself to establish the intent?
Your Honor, there has to be some evidence to suggest that that it was intentional, but as far as like the identity of the instrumentality,
look at that picture.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't take an expert to tell you that that was a very sharp instrument that caused that deep cut.
Yes.
So why couldn't the trial court have just inferred that a weapon must have been used based on the nature of the injury
and simply wasn't located?
Your Honor, I believe that that would have been a much better finding than the path that the trial court did did take. And I think that the trial court may have painted itself into a corner with this finding that it had to. The only evidence before it was evidence of a ring. So even though the trial court was disregarding and rejecting Hunter's story that it was self-defense and that there was some kind of mutual combat situation where Johnson was the aggressor, that he couldn't reject the testimony about the ring because they didn't find a knife. I think that if that was the court's line of thinking, it was incorrect. But, certainly it doesn't affect, I don't think, the outcome that we have here. I just think that it adds context to why the trial court perhaps said what it did regarding the ring.
Can I ask you about Jones?
Yes, Your Honor.
As Judge Petty's noted, it's an unpublished opinion, but your argument is that the assignment of error in Jones didn't focus this court as the first assignment of error in this case does, on that it was an error, I think it says as a matter of law and convicting him. It's not just a sufficiency question, which we sort of have in the second assignment of error in this case.
Yes, sir.
Is that the difference?
I think that
as far as preserving it?
The biggest difference is that in Jones, the assignment of error didn't talk about the statement that the trial court made. If it had, perhaps it would have been barred by 518. Here, the entire assignment of error in AE1 is premised on the trial court statement and accepting that the trial court statement was an unambiguous finding that there was no intent. I think that the premise falls apart when you start looking at the merits. I don't think that the trial court's statement was an unambiguous finding that there was no intent, but on the preservation issue, Your Honor, I think that if the assignment of error makes a statement about or is premised on that statement during the verdict, that there would have had to have been a contemporaneous objection that also alerted the trial court to the import of the statement.
Or sometimes it's a little difficult to do when the court is ruling and the court wants to be done, but you've got, I think the order's not entered until 3 months later, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've got 21 days after that to still do a motion to set aside or a motion to reconsider.
Yes, Your Honor. There was ample time for Mr. Hunter, by any number of methods, to have brought this to the trial court's attention and to have sought clarification and even an acquittal. If you really believe that the trial court had found that there was no intent, it's simple enough to say, hey, unlawful wounding requires proof of intent. You said there's no intent. Why are you convicting me? But instead, he kept his peace and then appealed on that grounds, and that goes to the heart of what 518 is intended to prevent and to not allow. I do think that Robertson is very illustrative. I know it's an unpub as well, but the logic that the court goes through in Robertson and the factual scenario where the trial court actually makes an explicit finding in that case that there was no intent, and so he's and then proceeds to convict him of a lesser included, and there's no objection that's raised, and then comes up on appeal and says, hey, the lesser included you convicted him of, which I don't think was actually a lesser included. I can't remember on that. That was the point that trial counsel did raise it before the trial court, didn't raise anything about the fact that the lesser included required proof of intent as well, appealed on that basis, and that was barred by 518, even though it was a situation where there was manifest error, where there was an unambiguous statement, and the very reason for busting is not very technically accurate, but reducing the charge down to a misdemeanor was because there was no intent. So you had manifest error, but it was still barred by 518, and it's a very similar situation here, even if you take for granted that this was a finding of no intent. So, and again, even if it is preserved, though, it's meritless. I think the court's already demonstrated that a grasp of most of my arguments that I made on brief, that we don't fix on isolated statements of the trial court, but rather we look at this in the context of the entire record. One of the most important facts is that the trial court goes on to convict Mr. Hunter. The trial court is presumed to know the law. These convictions come up with a presumption of correctness, and there's not enough in the record to suggest that based on this single, isolated, ambiguous statement by the trial court of I don't know that Hunter knew the extent of the injury, basically.
Sort of in the middle of his ruling, though, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe isolated, but isolated right in the middle of his ruling.
It's true, Your Honor. And again, I wouldn't put this in the bench book as a model of clarity. But it's on the appellant, the burden's on the appellant to establish that there was an unambiguous error here, and that's not present in this case. And I think that it was helpful, although it was at sentencing, but it illustrates what the trial court was thinking when it talked about how if this was a ring, then it was a ring that works a lot like a box cutter or a knife. I think that perhaps that gives us a little more insight into what the trial court was thinking about. And if you take that statement and you add it to the evidence that we do have, even if this was a ring, it was a very sharp ring. And Hunter would be presumed to know the probable effects of his actions. And if you look at those injuries, there was certainly ample evidence to suggest, even if we just fixate on that horrible cut, that if he's carrying around a ring that's sharp enough to do that, that and he punches someone with it, that he could be said to have the intent.
You know, he would have to know, in order for that to apply, he would have to know that that type of injury was the natural and probable consequence of hitting him in the face, because that's the inference you're trying to draw, that every person can be inferred to presume the natural and probable consequence of their action. I'm not sure that hitting someone with a closed fist with a ring on, you could say that the probable consequence of that act is an injury such as this.
Well, and what I intend to say is that if this is a ring, it's an abnormally sharp ring, Your Honor, and that he would be on notice by just the sharpness of it, that punching someone takes it outside of the ambit. That's true, Your Honor. And I think, again, it's sort of an anomaly of perhaps what the trial court thought it had to do and how it had to construe the evidence that was before it.
Do I recall correctly that the expert said that it's possible that it could have come from the ring, but to the extent that it could have, it wouldn't have been through a punch. It would have been through a situation where you're almost dragging the ring down the course of someone's skin, given that it came started at the cheek and went back to behind the ear.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that, you know, Dr. Box's testimony was, yeah, a ring could do that. But then he comes back and he says a single punch would not do that. And the testimony from both sides was that there was a single motion of something on his right side that wound up causing that cut. And in fact, Johnson testified he didn't even know that he'd been cut. It didn't register with him until he got in and looked in the mirror and saw his face gaping open. And that's when, you know, he went and sought treatment at that point. But it's not the sort of situation where he's sitting there and dragging it across, whatever it was that caused the cut. So just to bring it all back, I guess, the full circle, I would encourage the court or ask the court to look not just at the cut, but also at the broken bones in Johnson's face, and understand that even if perhaps he didn't know what the ring would do, he certainly did know that an attack of the violence that would be required to break all those facial bones in two punches, that he would be presumed to know the natural and probable consequences of those acts. And that was all before the trial court.
Along that line, can you extract someone's intent from the circumstances of the alleged offense? That is to say, if you're talking about a sucker punch or a surprise attack, does that create the reasonable inference that you know if you attack somebody that's in a more vulnerable position, you've got a lot better chance of injuring them at all, much less significantly, than you do if it's a square off and put up your duke situation?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I think that we've got quite a bit of case law on that point, that if it's a surprise attack that the expected, if we don't have case law on it, I think there's a reasonable inference that the Commonwealth can benefit from, that surprise attack is more likely to do more serious injury. And that was a factual finding, that he was surprise attacked, that he could not defend himself, that hasn't been assigned error to. The trial court found that those things, that it was a surprise, that he couldn't defend himself. So for all those reasons, we just ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Ms. Whitley, you have your rebuttal time. And as you're coming up, can you think about your response to Mr. Jones's point about, well, even if you put aside the horrific cut, the punches that caused the broken bones in the face and the nose?
Right, and I think the problem there for the Commonwealth arises, and I would first say that that was encompassed by a second assignment of error. So the second assignment of error is that broad, there is insufficient evidence. So that certainly was part and parcel of it, although we focus our argument on the laceration on the face. But the trial court actually made a statement in his finding, noting the facial fractures and the broken nose, but then saying that the fight caused that, but it could not have caused that. And that's because the doctor stated that the nose, both the radiologist and himself, they did not know if it happened before the fight. And I would direct, that's on Joint Appendix page 47 through 48 with the doctor's testimony. He also speaks to, reading his testimony in total, the injuries being acute, which can mean from 24 to 48 hours. I can highlight that section to the court. And the trial court, I would argue, in making its findings, relies on that. So the Joint Appendix, page 47, the question, you couldn't tell from the examination, and they're speaking about the fractures, whether it was before the injury to the cheek that day or some other time. The doctor says correct. and the radiologist could not tell if they were new or old. So I think that is problematic for the Commonwealth when it comes to relying on those injuries as a result of this altercation.
The victim testified that he didn't have those injuries before.
He did.
It's not inconsistent with what the doctor just said. The doctor just said he couldn't tell one way or another.
Right, and I believe the victim's exact testimony was the doctor told me that there were fractures in my face. I don't believe the Commonwealth actually did go through the steps of laying it out, saying, did you have those fractures before? But the victim did testify, the doctor told me.
Is the Commonwealth required to prove what caused that injury to the face, that slice?
I think the Commonwealth is required to exclude a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And I think that the problem here, and what I would argue to this court, by relying solely on the resulting injury, then we're removing those circumstantial evidence questions from the requirement of proof in cases like this.
If they had presented no evidence other than the testimony of the defendant and the pictures of it, why couldn't the court infer that that was a sharp, very sharp cutting instrument that caused that wound?
Well, then I think we're putting the defendant in the position of having to exclude every possible theory of guilt, which is the exact opposite of the burden of proof at trial. And I would highlight, I think Your Honor also asked the question about, can we rely solely on an injury to establish this intent in these types of cases? And I think that's a very dangerous path, because when we look back to the line of cases beginning or specifically relying on Rourke, where an individual died from a single punch of a fist, relying on the results of a fight in order to bootstrap it to the intent of the participants is not what this court has found required of the Commonwealth or of the defendant. So we have a situation where the court thinks there's probably something else, but there's no evidence that the Commonwealth puts on. It is their burden at trial. I understand we're in a different position now, but at trial, it's their obligation to establish that there was some type of weapon of which they could make an inference of a natural and probable consequences. And this trial court specifically finds that that inference doesn't exist at a minimum. And I would ask the court to consider that in particular when reviewing the case, specifically with assignment of error number 2. We do bring that again to the court's attention, even if it's not an automatic reversal under assignment number 1. At a minimum, the court has disconnected that inference of a natural and probable consequences of Mr. Hunter's actions. So we would ask the court to reverse and dismiss his indictments or remand it for a sentencing on assault and battery.
Okay, so just to be clear then, yes, that if we were to reverse, you are all right with not remanding for a new trial, but for remanding for resentencing on the lesser included misdemeanor?
I believe under assignment of error number 1, that would be the correct action, okay, as the court just didn't make the correct finding on the felony. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you.
We will recounsel, and then the next case.